then fled in search of a new bottleneck. In the large room, the Margols left at the back started to notice something wrong. They were catching snatches of a scent that vanished as quickly as it appeared. They noticed one of their number dead on the ground, far from the commotion of where the woman was kicking them back down the stairs. A second backline Margol fell dead, with no more sound than its body hitting the ground. A third soon followed. Margols had poor eyesight, relying much more on their sense of smell. As they had just come in out of the bright sun, their vision was all the worse. Several more of their number were silently slain before they noticed the dark figure moving amongst them, appearing and disappearing just as quickly. The monsters milled in confusion. Their baseline aggression, their large numbers in a relatively tight space, and the frustration of fighting enemies they couldn't pin down were becoming a toxic brew. Some of the Margols turned on one another. If it weren't for Sophie being forced to fall back, letting the monsters vent up the stairs in pursuit, the Margols may well have killed each other. Sometime later, Sophie and Jason were on the rooftop, fighting the last of the pack of Margols. Despite having their numbers whittled down as they pursued the pair through the building, the savage monsters never faltered in their furious assault until the last had fallen. Jason and Sophie then made their way down through the building, finishing off those two crippled to continue the chase. Jason touched each one to tag it for looting. "Would you like to loot Margol?" He would only accept once they were away from the bodies and the stink they would produce as they dissolved. As they scoured the building, Jason made a pleasant discovery. A dark cube lay in an alcove under a stairwell, in a place that the light outside would never reach. If it weren't for his ability to see in the dark, he would have never seen it at all. "Item: Dark Essence, unranked, uncommon. Manifested Essence of Darkness, consumable, essence. Requirements: less than 4 absorbed essences. Effect: imbues 1 awakened dark essence ability and 4 unawakened dark essence abilities. You have absorbed 4 of 4 essences. You do not meet the requirements to use this item." "Nostalgic," he mused to himself. "What's that?" Sophie asked, walking up to him. "I found an essence," Jason said. "It's a dark essence, which was my first." "Should go for a good price, right?" "It should," Jason said. "It's only uncommon, and there'll probably be a glut of essences on the market after all this, but dark is a popular one. It has great utility and is the last word in stealth essences. You should take it when we split up the loot after all this is done. The essences Belinda wants are all common, so you can probably trade this for 2 of them, or at least the magic essence and some solid awakening stones." They went out on the street in front of the building before Jason accepted all the loot messages. Soon rainbow smoke was streaming out of windows from the plume generated by all 41 bodies being converted at once. 41 monster cores, iron, have been added to your inventory. 410 iron rank spirit coins have been added to your inventory. 60 dog quintessence gems have been added to your inventory. 10 myriad quintessence gems have been added to your inventory. 410 iron rank spirit coins have been awarded to party member Sophie Wexler. 60 dog quintessence gems have been awarded to party member Sophie Wexler. 10 myriad quintessence gems have been awarded to party member Sophie Wexler. Sophie stepped back. Her loot dodge timing had improved enough that the 3 bags fell to the ground in front of her.
"So your power conjured the bags, right?" she asked.
"Yep," Jason said. "As I understand it, a looting power like mine or Neil's takes the magic from the monster as it merges with the ambient magic and makes items with it. Usually magical manifestations like spirit coins or these quintessence gems we just got, but sometimes items."
Belinda said Clive spent a whole day examining one of those bags to see if there was anything special about it.
"That does sound like him," Jason said. Sophie opened up one of the bags, taking out a quintessence gem to examine. It was like a diamond, almost spherical, but covered in tiny facets.
"Item: myriad quintessence, iron rank, legendary. Manifested essence of multiplicity. Crafting material, essence. Effect: crafting material for items with multiplicative attributes."
"Pretty," Jason said, as she held it up for him to see. It caught the bright sunlight, refracting rainbow colours.
"Legendary rarity," she said. "Should be valuable, right?"
"I imagine so," Jason said. The myriad essence is legendary too. Emily, the archer from Beth Cavendish's team, has it.
She's the Celestine? Sophie asked.
That's right. Sophie dropped the gem back into the bag and handed her loot to Jason for storage. He took out a notebook and recorded all the loot for splitting up later. As he wrote in it, Sophie craned her head back to watch the rainbow smoke from more than 40 monsters rising up from the building.
All those monsters, she said. It's like this place has a monster surge going on.
It essentially does, Jason said, putting his notebook away. A monster surge is a weeks-long increase in magical saturation.
You haven't experienced one, right? She asked. They don't have them in your world?
We don't have monsters at all, Jason said. I've only been learning about how they work studying astral magic with Clive.
I hope he's doing all right.
Clive had become worried once he realized that none of his team had arrived with him through the archway. As people started forming makeshift teams, he didn't expect to find anyone looking for his eclectic selection of powers. His unconventional abilities worked best when used in conjunction with people who knew and were prepared for them. A hastily formed team would do better with a ranged attacker with straightforward powers that they could readily adapt to. He considered pulling a Jason and adjusting the perspective through which he described his abilities, but immediately dismissed the idea. Worse than no one wanting him on their team would be getting abandoned in the middle of a monster-infested city for misrepresenting what he had to contribute. One of the people present had the exact opposite problem. He wasn't a large man. His slight physique reminded Clive of Jason. If the man's blonde hair and fair skin hadn't marked him as one of the foreign adventurers, the impressive equipment Clive recognized did. Once equipment passed a certain level of expense, it started to move from ostentatious back to unremarkable. And this man's equipment looked very unremarkable indeed. Clive knew it to be the kind of expensive that was wasted on iron rank gear, unless you had so much money to throw around it was laughable. The man looked to be wearing light and simple clothes, but Clive picked out the subtle signs in the way the cloth draped that signaled incredibly powerful reinforcement magic. It was the kind of armor favored by adventurers with mobility and high-skill power sets. He had a sword at his hip, with a ring at the top of the scabbard that most would dismiss as part of the design. Clive recognized it as a magic item that would impart extra damage to the first strike after drawing the blade. The man's jacket was made of supple leather, protective without being constrictive. Clive knew from the odd way it conformed to the body shape underneath that it was a dimensional jacket, much like that used by Emir Bahadir. The other foreign adventurers clearly knew who he was and were all clamoring to form a team with him. To Clive's surprise, the man's eyes picked him out. The man walked away from the people inviting him to their groups and straight over to Clive.
"You're Clive Standish," the man said.
"That's right," Clive said. "I'm not sure who you are, but you're wearing more expensive gear than I've seen on a bronze ranker."
The man let out a friendly chuckle.
"Which means either someone didn't trust me to survive," he said, "or thinks I'm worth it."
"You're worth it," Clive said. "If someone doesn't have the skill, you spend that money very differently."
The man laughed again and held out his hand for Clive to shake.
"I'm Valdis. You live up to your reputation, Mr. Standish."
"Clive is fine," Clive said.
"I have a reputation.
I like to keep informed. The authorities in Greenstone know a lot more about the Builder cult than most provincial areas, and your contributions have been a large part of that. Word just hasn't gotten around yet, because of how closely information is being held right now."
"But not from you, it seems," Clive said.
"My father has some small standing overseas, which affords me a little more influence than I really deserve.
My father's an eel farmer, which affords me more long, slimy fish than I really want."
Valdis laughed once more, clearly more comfortable with their circumstances than most of the adventurers present. Clive noticed the unhappy looks from the adventurers who had been courting Valdis's attention.
"Would you like to form a group with me, Clive?"
"I should warn you," Clive said. "My abilities can be a bit complicated. My damage comes in bursts, and a lot of my abilities require anticipation and setup."
"Your confluence is the karmic essence, if I recall correctly, yes?"
"Yes," Clive said. "You really do like to keep informed. I have some retributive damage buffs and a lot of mana recovery. Mostly I attack with staves and wands, but I have a big, versatile attack spell."
I know someone with the karmic essence, Valda says. She says that judgment and timing are the keys to success.
I'd have to agree, Clive said.
I'm a classic swordsman myself, sword, swift, adept, master. More mana-intensive abilities than you'd expect with that combo, though. So I'll look forward to that mana recovery you mentioned. Assuming you want to join me.
Definitely, Clive said.
Great, Valdis said, rubbing his hands together as he turned his attention to the group listening in on them.
Let's find ourselves some team members.
Chapter 49. The Danger Is Us. In the time they had spent allowing Sophie to recover, some other groups had moved deeper into the city. They started seeing traces as they went. The plants and buildings showed traces of essence abilities having been used on them. They knew they weren't far behind another group when they found monsters that had yet to dissolve into smoke.
Can you loot them? Sophie asked.
Probably not, Jason said, touching a finger to the dead monster.
This monster kill was not yours. You are unable to loot this monster.
Nope, Jason said. It only lets me loot when the killer is me or someone in my party.
Does Neil's ability have that restriction?
Not exactly, but the monster has to die inside his aura, so it works out about the same.
Should we veer off our straight line? Sophie asked. We aren't going to get much training in if all the monsters we find are dead.
May as well, Jason said. So long as we're going more or less the right way, it should be fine. The pair discovered their most effective tactical patterns as the days passed and they encountered monsters almost hourly. It was mostly some variation on Sophie grabbing the monster's attention while Jason moved in to flank. Sometimes she would lead them around, other times standing her ground or staging running fights through buildings. Every day in the city was like weeks of monster hunting outside it, with both Jason and Sophie unrelenting in the hunt. For Sophie, it was a chance to grab at power, both to share with Belinda and to give herself freedom from anyone who tried to control her fate. For Jason, it was the culmination of a long wait. He had been putting off advancement and getting more awakening stones in the anticipation of Emir's grand event. He was now determined to complete his power set with the best awakening stones he could find. If nothing else, he resolved to get the necrotic damage affliction that had been absent from his kit from the beginning. Rufus kept telling him it would come, but with each new awakening stone, it had remained elusive. As the days passed, they also encountered other adventurers. None were people they knew well, if at all, but the Greenstone adventurers tended to recognize Jason, or at least his cloak. The encounters ranged from the friendly to the wary, with the foreign adventurers being especially careful. From the brief interactions, Jason and Sophie realized the foreign adventurers were most wary of each other. There was concern over rivals trying to remove their competition directly. Given that all the groups were now mixed, Jason and Sophie agreed that they were better off out of it and sticking together. Each night, they would alternate meditating, sleeping, and keeping watch. Sleep got the shortest shrift, as they both had effective stamina recovery powers that kept them powering forward through the day. Not to say that there weren't distractions in the downtime.
What are you doing?
Sophie asked, as she crawled, bleary-eyed, out of the aura tent.
I'm trying to teach Colin to spell, Jason said.
The Leech Collective was laid out in the shape of the word plurb.
I think he might be evil after all, Jason continued. He only gets the rude words right.
Their abilities improved rapidly. Just the first few days had seen almost every ability Jason had advancing at least a level. His lowest abilities, his conjured dagger and his execute power, advanced twice. Sophie's abilities advanced even faster as she had started off lower. On the fifth day, they once again encountered an adventurer, but this one was dead. Sophie frowned as she crouched down to examine the body. He was a male Leonid, much of his fur burned off in patches, matching localized scorch marks on his clothes and skin.
I've seen this before, she said. Bodies left like this.
A monster you've seen?
No, she said. A person.
There's an arena fighter they call Fire Fist. One essence, one ability. Like me. You can guess what it is from the name. He liked to play with his opponents, take his time killing them.
This is what it looked like when he did. You think someone did what I did with you? Gave him the essences to become an adventurer?
I doubt it, she said. The last I saw of him was when I left him dangling from a cage by his broken arms. People aren't inclined to lift up losers.
You never actually met Thadwick Mercer, did you? I see your point, though. Maybe it was a monster with fire powers.
I don't think so, Sophie said. Enough adventurers are worried about people thinning out the competition that it's likely a real concern. Also, I'm not sure this is an environment likely to produce fire monsters. Plus, I think this body has been stripped of magical items. The boots are gone, and these clothes are under armor padding. There isn't any magic jewelry or dimensional bag.
Fair points, Jason said. If he was a Greenstone adventurer, he might have just been poor. I don't think any of the Greenstone participants were Leonids, though. They were all in the foreign group, and the worst of them were equipped as well as the best local.
Whether a monster or a person did this, Sophie said, this man was most likely in a group. If his companions didn't take him, they were either driven off or killed. We should look for more bodies.
You're right, Jason said. Let's hope we don't find any.
Every adventurer with a storage space or dimensional bag was carrying specialized caskets for storing corpses. The Adventure Society, in acknowledgement of the risks the Iron Rankers faced, had placed a reward for anyone who retrieved the remains of the fallen. The reward had been high to incentivize the return of the dead, but not so high as to incentivize murder for profit. They found a second dead Leonid out on the street and a third Leonid, even worse for wear than the others, in a nearby building.
This was definitely torture, Sophie said, as they crouched over the third corpse. There aren't any big burns like with the other body. Whoever did this took their time.
Look at the bruising on the wrists and ankles, Jason said. They were tied up. The neck, too, but not as bad. Whatever was around it was padded, like a suppression collar.
He stood up, frowning, and Sophie did the same.
They took this man's powers, tied him up, and then tortured him, Jason said. This wasn't just taking out the competition. Whoever did this wanted something. Information?
There's no way to know what the foreign adventurers have going on between them, Sophie said. I know you like to get your head around things, but don't get distracted by something we don't have enough information about. For all we know, it could just be sadists getting their thrills, or some weird Leonid hater.
Jason nodded. You're right. This is an easy place to get away with blaming the deaths on misadventure.
So, what do we do? Sophie asked.
We put him in a casket, Jason said. Then we see if there are any more before we keep going. It's not like we weren't being cautious already.
And if whoever did this tries to do it to us, trying to capture them and lug them around while we finish the trials won't work.
No, it won't, Jason said.
Rufus once told me that when you're out on an adventure, sometimes all the justice you get is putting the other guy down. So if we get attacked, we put them down. All the way down.
Good, Sophie said. I was a little worried you'd want to try some half measure that would put us in danger.
No, Jason said grimly. We need to make sure that the danger is us.
The giant lizard monster lunged at Humphrey, its huge jaws open wide. Humphrey opened his own mouth in turn, fire blasting from it into the monster's gaping maw. It wasn't critical damage to the bronze rank monster, but the flame licking the inside of its mouth made it flinch back and snap its mouth shut. This exposed the rest of its face. Humphrey stepped forward, swinging his most powerful special attack into the side of the monster's head, cracking bone and bursting one huge eye. It was the turning point in the fight. The rest of the group poured attacks into the staggered monster until it fell.
Impressive, as expected from Danielle Geller's son, Lowell said.
Lowell was one of the foreign adventurers and had the good fortune to have four of his 16 members arrive on the same tower. Humphrey had joined them for the journey to the center of the city, where he could rejoin his own team, but Lowell had other ideas.
I know you have some affection for that team of locals you put together, Lowell said, but clearly you're a good fit with us.
I'm quite happy with my current team, Humphrey said coldly.
His normal social graces were being steadily eroded by Lowell's constant efforts at recruitment. He had moved from the oblique,
to the direct.
I understand that, Lowell said. But to be frank, your time is wasted with the inferior team.
Agreed, Humphrey snarled. But I was separated from mine by the archway, so I'll have to make do.
Wait, what?
Lowell asked, his smarmy veneer cracking.
You think some grab bag of provincials is better than us?
Actually, Carly interjected, he's just running out of patience with you disrespecting his team.
Sorry about Lowell, Humphrey. He's a good guy, but he has trouble seeing things from other people's perspectives. He gets an idea in his head, and it's hard to dislodge.
Carly's right, Hampstead agreed. If I was Geller, I'd have already dislodged your whole damn head, Lowell.
It's fine, Humphrey said. Let's just keep moving. Outside the astral space, Emir's cloud palace was sitting on the lake, with Rufus sitting with his parents on an outdoor terrace just above the water level. They had strong-armed Rufus into relaxing properly for the first time since Farah died. Emir and Constance were also present, along with Farah's parents, who they had recruited to make sure Rufus had no recourse. It was morning, and they were taking tea, looking out over the lake and the picturesque towns and villages around it. The bright, lush greens of the shoreline were an appealingly stark contrast to the desert beyond. There were too many of the small communities to count, around a lake that was practically an inland sea.
Sky Scar Lake,
Farah's mother, Amelia, mused.
I wonder where the name came from.
It's a local legend, Constance volunteered. It's said that people settled this land long ago, but angered the gods who struck them down. The force of the gods' wrath withered the land, turning fertile ground into desert, and producing the hole that became the lake as we see it today.
There are elements of truth to that, Emir said. There were indeed people who settled here long ago, and they were struck down by the churches rather than the gods themselves, but still. Of course, the desert and the lake were already here when all that happened.
I'd love to visit some more of these villages, Amelia said. The ones nearby have been quite delightful. It would be nice to see some not quite so thrown into a tizzy by the sudden appearance of a giant floating palace at their doorstep.
You wouldn't know it, Rufus's father Gabriel said, but there is actually a less grandiose form of the palace. I'd bet Amir hasn't used it since our adventuring days, though, back when we made him use it.
I'm hosting a grand event, Amir said. It requires grandeur.
Amir, you think putting on socks requires grandeur, Gabriel said.
That's because I have exceptional socks, Amir said. It's not my fault you don't treat your feet with the care they deserve.
One of Amir's staff came in, whispering something to Constance, who frowned.
Can I borrow Rufus for a moment? She asked.
She and Rufus were soon walking through the Cloud Palace together.
What is it?
Rufus asked.
Adras Dorgan is here, she said.
In person?
Yes.
He must have found something to come in person.
Constance led Rufus to a receiving room where Dorgan was waiting. It was small, but still had the sunset colours and comfortable cloud furniture ubiquitous in a cloud palace. Constance left the two men together and departed.
Dorgan, Rufus said as they sat. I take it from your personal presence that you have something.
Yes and no, Dorgan said. Partly I came because I didn't think they'd let any of my people through the door. I've been doing as you asked, and I've definitely turned things up. I keep running into strange dead ends, however.
Strange how?
Someone is hiding things. Someone with the kind of power and influence that I would normally run from like they were a woman with upholstery samples. I know what's at stake here, though. So I kept digging.
And?
And I started losing people. Someone is disappearing any of my people that touch on certain areas. What's worse, they clearly don't fear reprisal. I can't keep sending people to their deaths.
That's fair, Rufus said. So, what have you managed to get?
I have a lot of pieces that don't quite fit, Dorgan said. Private shipping expeditions with way too much secrecy. Bribes in amounts that boggle the mind.
whole companies set up, doing one quiet job and then closing down again, all to hide whoever was really behind the deals. If you look at it all together, it very nearly adds up to something.
You came out here for a reason, Rufus said. What do you need from me?
I need someone to ask the questions I can't, Dorgan said. To poke the dark corners my people keep vanishing into.
Anything more specific?
Whoever is covering this thing up on the top end is powerful and influential, Dorgan said. More than the local powers can manage because they have foreign influence and no small amount of it. I can't go looking deeper than I have into who they are. If you can find that out for me, then I can maybe put all the parts into place. I can't look in the dark corners, but if I know who are hiding in them, I can follow their open activities. I know enough of the shady stuff that if I know what legitimate activities to watch, I think I can bring you something you need.
Rufus took a long, slow breath, his eyes glued to Dorgan's face.
I might know who you're talking about, Rufus said. Nothing is confirmed, however, and telling you would be no small thing. This is information that is still extremely restricted, and we're keeping it that way until we have some proof. We haven't even shared our suspicions with the Adventure Society yet.
Dorgan got to his feet, Rufus doing the same.
Well, when you get around to telling people, you come see me, Dorgan said. He took a paper folder from his jacket and handed it to Rufus. This is everything my people were able to find, with some observations from me about what various bits of it could mean. Until that information you're sitting on gets a little less restricted, this is as much as I can do for you. Just to be clear, I'm not saying I won't help. I'm saying I can't.
Rufus was leafing through the notes as Dorgan spoke. He looked up at the crime lord, giving him an assessing gaze.
Please wait here, Rufus said. I'll have some refreshments sent in while I talk to some people.
Rufus left, and when he returned, Dorgan was enjoying tea and scones.
Dorgan, Rufus said, without preamble, I'm going to tell you something, and you are going to do your very best in all your dealings to obfuscate the fact that I did.
All right, Dorgan said warily, putting down his teacup and getting up from his chair.
You said you needed to know what influential power was hiding things.
That's right. Rufus visibly steeled himself, taking a long pause before speaking again.
Church of Purity, he said, quietly.
Dorgan's eyes grew wider and wider as the implications of what Rufus had said settled in. He ran his hands through his hair and started pacing back and forth before he stopped and turned back to Rufus.
What kind of madness have you dragged me into?
Chapter 50. Surplus to Requirements.
Jason and Sophie continued their way through the city of Fallen Echoes. More cautious than ever, they exposed themselves to long sight lines as little as possible. Sometimes they used narrow streets to hide themselves from above, at other times rooftops of dilapidated buildings to hide themselves from below. Helping them remain unobtrusive was the quiet nature of their essence abilities. Only the burst accompanying Sophie's windblade made any real noise, and, compared to the cries of the monsters they fought, it wasn't especially loud. Later in the day they had found the three dead Leonids, something finally happened that they had been waiting for.
Party member, Neil Devone, has entered communications range. Voice chat with Neil Devone has been restored. Full party interface functionality has been restored to party member, Neil Devone. Party member Neil Devone has been located on ability, map.
Jason stopped, ducked into the shade of a ruined building, and opened a voice chat.
Neil?
Jason?
Good to hear from you. Are you all right?
Yeah. I've got Jory with me, plus another guy who's a pretty good front line. We could use a good damage dealer, but you'll do.
Ah, thanks for that vote of confidence. It's just me and Wexler here. Humphrey's probably fine, but I hope Clive's all right.
Hello, Sophie, Neil said.
Neil, Sophie reciprocated. We'll need to figure out where we each are.
I've got that covered, Jason said. He pulled up his map, quickly locating Neil.
Looks like you're east and a little south of us, Jason said.
This place has an east? Neil asked.
It may have been arbitrarily designated by my map power. I'm not sure. Find somewhere to hole up and we'll come to you.
Jason and Sophie reoriented themselves, heading towards Neil's location on the map. They had been moving around for around 10 minutes when they received a chat from Neil. It had the whispered tone that came with the communication sent silently via a thought.
Someone is here, Neil's voice came. From the way they're acting, I think they were following us and got thrown when we stopped to wait for you.
Hang tight and we'll get there as fast as we can, Jason said.
What does hang tight mean?
Neil asked. Come on, you can get it from context, Jason complained.
Clear communication is important in tactical scenario,
Neil said.
Boys, we can sort this out later, Sophie said. Asano, shut up. Neil, we'll be as quick as we can.
Sophie and Jason gave up on stealth for speed, rushing along streets as quickly as they could. Jason was no match for Sophie's speed, even when she was just using her abilities passively. Once she started using them actively, navigating the complicated terrain like it was a track course, only his shadow teleporting allowed him to keep up. At each junction, he checked his map and kept them on the right heading.
They found us,
Neil said, through voice chat.
We're getting close, Jason said. A few more minutes.
Jason and Sophie had no more speed to pour on as they raced through the overgrown streets.
We've got a fire user, a wind user, and a big guy with a hammer. Neil kept them updated. Jory is laughing like a loon for some reason I don't Oh, damn.
What happened? Sophie asked.
Give me a second.
Neil's hurried voice came back.
We're doing okay,
Neil said a few moments later, his voice light with surprise.
Keen, that's our frontliner, is holding off their big guy just fine. The two women with the elemental powers are throwing everything at us, but Jory is soaking up all their elemental attacks and using them to fuel his own abilities. What's that guy doing spending his days in a clinic?
Just hold on, Jason said. We'll be there soon.
Shouldn't be an issue, Neil said. They just keep throwing elemental attacks. What in the world is that?
Neil? Jason asked.
The other adventurers are running, Neil said. There's a wave of some ghost-looking things coming down the street. I think they might be those things the shadow guy warned us about.
The Vorger, Jason said.
Yeah, Neil said.
The people we were fighting had movement powers and bolted, but we can't move faster than these things are going.
Regroup and protect each other as best you can, Jason said. Sophie and I should be well equipped to handle them.
Probably.
Probably?
Neil asked.
It's better than definitely not.
Jason and Sophie spotted the Vorger before they spotted Neil, Jory, and the other man they picked up. The Vorger looked like something between a fog bank and a swarm, their forms white and ethereal, taking all manner of shapes. Some looked like animals, others monsters, or even humanoid shapes, although Shade had told them the shape didn't matter. Whatever their form, it was the touch of the creatures that would warp and distend flesh. Jason and Sophie got a look at the results, sprinting past what used to be a person, judging from the pieces of armor and scraps of cloth on the hideous blob of flesh. They didn't pause, continuing the rush to help their companions.
I think we found one of your runoff adventurers, Jason told Neil through voice chat. The big guy, from your description. I guess he wasn't as fast as the others.
In the midst of the Vorger swarm, Neil was all right for the moment, but things were rapidly getting worse. His mana shield power held off any Vorger who rushed at him, but each time the bubble-like barrier flashed, it ate away at his mana to keep him safe. Keen had left his sword in its sheath. His hands were both occupied by a large shield, a translucent blue object that was obviously a magical construct. He used it to intercept and push back the Vorger as they swept in at him and Jory, who was crouched down beside him. Jory's leg had been brushed by one of the creatures and was locked into a folded position, forcing him to kneel down. In front of him, vials and little bottles were lifting themselves out of his belts and pockets, disgorging liquids and powers to float together. Unlike the black blob that had formed the last time he used the ability, this one was a shimmering pale blue.
I'll show you flesh warping, he muttered, and the blob streamed into his mouth.
His body grew skinny and long, his limbs stretching out. Sweat oozed out of his skin, coating him in a shimmering oil. He stood up, his elongated leg no longer afflicted. He started flailing his arms around like whips, the Vorja dissolving into nothing at the touch of the oil coating Jory's limbs. For his part, Neil decided to act before his manner was so drained he could no longer cast spells. Even as the Vorja continued lashing themselves against his mana shield, he started chanting. Come forth, wheels of fortune. Let destiny fair and foul be brought upon those here to receive it. In the air above Neil's head, three stone wheels, translucent and immaterial, came into being. They were stacked horizontally atop one another, and each had a series of images inscribed on their edges. Most of the images were of Vorja, but each wheel also had an image of Neil, Jory, and Keen's faces. Ability, Reels of Fortune, Prosperity, Spell. This ability has variable subtypes, contingent on effect. Cost, High Mana, Cooldown, 10 minutes. Current rank, Iron, 7, 41%. Effect, Iron. Conjures three immaterial reels. Channel mana into the reels to generate random effects on random individuals within the area. If an individual is affected more than once by the same use of the reels, the effect is increased for each reel. Just conjuring the reels had eaten a good chunk of his dwindling mana, and he immediately spent even more channeling it into the reels. By their nature, the inherent randomness of the reels gave the ability a mixed level of reliability at best. But as Neil's mana plunged, he was betting everything on how much the Vorja's numbers stacked the odds. He had chosen to use the reels not just for the spell's potential power, but because they were so outnumbered by the Vorja that the odds had become skewed. This was borne out as the wheels stopped turning and the images on the front lit up, each one showing a Vorja. Strange lightning shot out of the wheels, a black streak limned in white, chaining through the Vorja one to another. Each Vorja struck burst into nothing, like mist under the bright sun. For each Vorja that dissolved, a matching image disappeared from each of the wheels, but there were so many of them that the difference was slight. The Vorja rapidly perished, and Neil and everyone else were rejuvenated as the dying Vorja triggered Neil's aura power. Ability, Spoils of Victory, Prosperity, Aura, Recovery, Conjuration, Cost, None, Cooldown, None, Current Rank, Iron, 8, 19%. Effect, Iron. Allies within your aura recover mana and stamina for each enemy that dies within your aura, as well as a minor healing effect. You can loot enemies that die within your aura. Neil's depleting mana was noticeably replenished as the Vorja were killed by his spell. With his mana pool restored, Neil's mana shield was once again a safe refuge from the ghostly creatures. It also helped Keen, who had suffered a number of Vorja strikes in spite of his conjured shield. The healing, uncramped joints that the flesh-warping attacks had locked up. Neil channeled more mana into the wheels, and they started turning again. While Neil and Jory were in the process of turning the tables, Jason and Sophie finally reached the fight, plowing straight in at full speed. Jason's sword was already out, slashing away at the ghost-like Vorja. Special attack, Leech Bite, has inflicted bleeding on Vorja. Vorja is immune to bleeding. Bleeding does not take effect. Affliction immunity has triggered an effect on weapon, Dread Salvation. Weapon, Dread Salvation, has gained an instance of Spellbreaker. Instances quickly stacked up on Jason's sword, and it was soon slashing apart the Vorja with ease, while Sophie's unarmed attacks had a similar effect. She was also seemingly impervious to the Vorja's touch, while Jason enjoyed his own protection. Special attack, Vorja's touch has inflicted Vorja's Flesh Warp on you. You have resisted Vorja's Flesh Warp. Vorja's Flesh Warp does not take effect. You have gained an instance of Resistant. When Jason and Sophie appeared in the fight, their faces also appeared on the reels, but the second turn of the spell also ended in triple Vorja. Luck was still on the adventurer's side. This time an energy wave rolled out of the reels and touched the closest of the Vorja. Its translucent body turned from white to black. Then it exploded. A nearby Vorja caught in the explosion similarly turned black and exploded in turn. The effect kept chaining until it finally petered out, the Vorja spreading out until the explosions no longer caught them. Between the explosions and the previous chains of dark lightning, Neil had eradicated a full third of the Vorja swarm. The next turn of the reel rested on images of two Vorja and a picture of Jory's face. An explosion in the midst of the Vorja took out a further chunk of their number, although not close to as many as the three real effects. Human has been affected by Reels of Fortune. Duration of ability, Alchemical Abomination, has been increased. The Vorja fought to the last, but accomplished little. Jory's new form was as immune to their attacks as Jason and Sophie were, all three laying into the Vorja with abandon. The magical protections of Neil and the other man, Keen, still held, protecting them until the fight was over. In the end, Jason and Sophie felt rather surplus to requirements. They shredded their share of the ghost creatures, but most were eradicated by Neil's spell, followed by Jory and his weird shape-changing power. Once the Vorja were gone, the adventurers regrouped, relieved to have weathered the ordeal so well. "Good to see you," Jason said, clapping Neil on the shoulder as Jory greeted Sophie warmly. "We should find a quiet place to spend the night that isn't here," Jason said. "We need to be careful," Neil said. "Those people are still around somewhere."
"I think we might have passed one who didn't run fast enough," Sophie said. "There was a big blob of flesh back there that I think used to be a person."
"He got killed?" Neil asked.
"The Vorja do not kill," Shade said,
his shadowy figure suddenly standing next to them.
"They alter."
They all turned in the direction from which Jason and Sophie had come. Shambling towards them was a flesh monstrosity, a four-legged asymmetrical mound that as much undulated forward as walked. "Wexler," Jason said, looking at the creature. "Am I imagining things, or is that thing a lot bigger than when we ran past it?" Chapter 51. A Worse Plan. Clive's team were making their way up through a building that became more precarious as they climbed. It was the tallest building they had encountered in the city, almost as tall as the archway towers on which they had arrived. This section of the city was more akin to forest than jungle. The remnant building sat in the shadow of towering trees. The building they were climbing through stood higher than the trees around it. It held its structural integrity despite one especially tall tree growing right up through the building itself. The building appeared to be some kind of elaborate palace. The expensive construction gave it a sound foundation, but every floor they climbed showed increased signs of collapse.
"I'm starting to think the danger outweighs the promise of treasure," Clive said.
"If His Highness says we should check it out, we check it out," Abarca said.
Abarca, Campos, and Hildebrand were the team members Valdis had picked out to join them. Valdis had suggested a voting system rather than picking a leader for their makeshift team. The three agreed immediately, as they had with every subsequent idea Valdis had come up with. Valdis, it turned out, was a prince from the diminutive but influential Kingdom of Mirrors. Small, affluent, and geographically blessed, it had neither expanded its borders nor had its borders encroached upon in more than 8 centuries. This was due to the diamond ranker known as the Mirror King, who founded the kingdom and ruled it through to the present day. Through the centuries, the Mirror King had a series of queens, reportedly doting on each, even as they grew old and died beside him. Valdis was one of the current queen consort's sons. Valdis was convinced there must be some great treasure at the top of the towering edifice, and the other three agreed on principle. Clive had known there was no point arguing with Valdis's three yes-men, but was compelled to ask what made Valdis so confident.
"No one tells the story of the thing they found in the safe, sensible place," Valdis told him.
"A grand treasure atop a crumbling palace with a mighty tree growing right through it. That's a story that gets you waking up in someone else's bedchamber, Clive, my friend."
Valdis threw a friendly arm around Clive's shoulder.
"Stick with me and you'll have yourself a wild time."
"I'm pretty confident that we'll be having a wild time regardless," Clive said. "I'm mostly interested in surviving to tell that story."
Valdis just laughed and continued on, confidently leading the way. Clive liked Valdis, whose reckless enthusiasm reminded him of Jason. Clive had let himself be dragged by Jason into enough things he ended up enjoying that he wasn't opposed to Valdis's idea. That same comparison also compelled him to be the voice of reason. They navigated the main part of the building, the most intact section, without incident. Then they reached a set of 6 towers, interconnected at various heights by different walkways. It reminded Clive of the Mercer family home, whose interlocking towers were a signature of the Greenstone skyline.
The towers were not as solid as the building below them, which became all the more evident as they ascended the crumbling stairs inside them. They started with the most intact-looking tower, but internal damage forced them to switch towers via the walkways more than once. The walkways, however, were even sketchier than the towers. Once fully enclosed tunnels, whole sections of the floor had long given way. They crossed one at a time, Clive trying to convince himself he was imagining the feeling of the bricks shifting under every step. Valdus lightly pranced through, using a light step power usually used for water walking that reduced the pressure he placed with each footstep. Clive was not so blessed, carefully wending his way past the holes in the floor. The first two tunneled walkways were crossed without incident. They reached the third to discover it had mostly entirely collapsed away. The roof was gone, as were most of the walls and a large section in the middle of the floor. The only thing connecting one side to the other across the gap was a mostly intact section of wall.
"This is really not a good idea," Clive said. "I think we should call it off."
"We're almost there," Valdus said. Above them was a huge stone platform, the towers holding it up like the legs of a giant beast. Valdus was still convinced something amazing awaited them at the top. Looking at the missing middle section of the walkway, though, even the other three were becoming wary.
"Surely there's a way to get us all across," Valdus said.
"Clive, you're clever.
I bet you can figure something out."
Clive frowned.
"Yes," he said reluctantly.
He opened his storage space, a circle of runes he reached through, to start plucking out items. He took out 4 pitons, a hammer, and 2 lengths of rope.
"We fasten the ends of these ropes at each end," Clive explained. "One high and one low. We run them along the wall where the gap is, edging our way along the low one as we use the wall and the high one for balance."
"So, you need me to go over and fasten the other end?" Valdus said.
"Yes," Clive said. "I would like to point out that you're the only one of us with a slow fall power, so your enthusiasm isn't tempered like the rest of ours."
"It'll be fine," Valdus said.
And for most of the crossing it was. Valdus used a wall run to cross the gap and secured the ropes at the other end, allowing Clive, Abarca, and Campos to cross. The final member of the group, Hildebrand, let nerves get the better of him, the rope slipping through his fingers as he fell. Clive rushed to the edge, his gaze moving from Valdus to the falling Hildebrand as he quickly incanted a spell.
"Exchange your fates."
Hildebrand vanished, his mid-air position now occupied by a startled Valdus. Hildebrand was standing in the spot from which Valdus had been looking over the edge himself. Clive grabbed the disoriented and still screaming Hildebrand before he fell off again. Abarca and Campos were still yelling at Clive by the time Valdus made his way back up. Without the others, Valdus had made much better time than when they had ascended together. Both Abarca and Campos expressed their relief at his reappearance.
"What's the issue?" Valdus asked.
"You knew I had a slow fall power."
"That was some sharp thinking, Clive."
"I told you this was dangerous," Clive said.
"And I told you it would be fine," Valdus said.
"Did these guys give you a hard time?"
"It doesn't matter," Clive said.
"Should I go back and grab the rope?" Valdus asked.
"We have to get back down, remember?"
"Right, yes."
After the slow and almost disastrous crossing of the walkway, they were able to climb the tower all the way to the top. The stairs emerged through the floor of the massive platform that spanned the towers, which looked to have been cut from a single piece of stone. There were 6 statues in the middle of the platform, standing in a circle and facing inward. They each had a plinth in front of them with various items, but the group's attention was drawn to the center of the circle. In the middle of the circle was a large creature, a wingless dragon the size of an elephant, with powerful legs and a tail that ended in a wicked stinger. Its scales were brown and grey, matte to the point that it looked rather like a large rock. The creature had sensed them, languidly getting up from where it had been sunning itself in the middle of the platform. Stretching its limbs, it eyed them hungrily.
"Mountain worm,"
Valdus said, the usual amusement absent from his voice.
"A little one, only bronze rank, probably, but still powerful.
It can draw strength from stone to heal and toughen itself. Honestly, I don't think we can beat it here. The rest of you go back down, and I'll distract it for as long as I can, then jump over the side. Use your escape medallions if you have to."
Clive and the others had all chosen the path of wisdom, receiving the life-preserving items from Shade. Only Valdis had taken the courage option. Hildebrand didn't hesitate at Valdis's words, bounding back down the stairs. Abaka and Campus followed, after a quick glance at Valdis's determined gaze locked on the monster.
"Edge!"
Clive yelled, running away from the stairs and towards the side of the platform.
"What?"
Valdis asked, looking at Clive in confusion, before grinning in realization and also running.
"Are you sure that will work?" Valdis called out.
"Probably,"
Clive called back.
"Probably?
You have a better plan?"
"You heard my plan."
"That was a worse plan,"
Clive yelled.
"You go over the side either way."
Valdis easily caught up with Clive. Behind him, the worm was moving in their direction on powerful legs, but its heavy body moved no more quickly than Clive did, and they made it to the edge of the platform well ahead of it. Clive came to a stop, pulling out a silver spirit coin. Clive knew the bronze rank monster would likely resist his spell. Consuming a spirit coin to boost his attributes past the monster's rank to silver would make Clive's spell more likely to take effect. It presented a dangerous risk-reward proposition, for if his spell failed anyway, he would be left weak and helpless in front of the monster. Clive shoved the coin in his mouth without hesitation, as Valdis leapt off the side of the tower. Clive looked between him and the dragon, casting his spell as he felt the power of the coin surge through him.
"Exchange your fates.
You have used spell, juxtaposition, on Valdis Volaire, and Lesser Mountain Worm.
Lesser Mountain Worm has resisted. Juxtaposition does not take effect. Spell cooldown is reset due to spell failure." "Crap,"
he tried again.
"Exchange your fates. Exchange your fates. Oh, come on."
He could feel the fleeting power of the spirit coin about to drain away. He looked at Valdis, drifting slowly downward, then back at the draconic monster that was almost upon him.
"Exchange your fates."
The monster vanished, replaced with Valdis. Valdis ran over and they looked over the side, watching the monster crash through the tops of the trees below. Clive dropped to his hands and knees at the edge of the platform, panting in exhaustion as he looked over the side.
"Think it'll kill it?"
he asked.
"Maybe the trees will cushion its fall."
"Maybe," Valdis said. "If it survives, it can heal itself up with a stone on the ground."
"You defeated Lesser Mountain Worm." "No, it's dead,"
Clive said with relief. He had no interest in facing the monster again after they went back down.
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure."
"I should probably go get those three before they try that rope again, then."
"You go right ahead,"
Clive said, rolling onto his back to lay spread-eagled on the platform.
"I'm just going to lay here for a bit."
Valdis eventually returned with the other three, who, despite the prince's assurances, poked their heads up over the edge of the stairwell warily before coming all the way up. Valdis walked back over to Clive.
"Ready to get back up?" Valdis asked.
"No."
Valdis laughed, holding out a hand to pull Clive to his feet. Clive groaned as he went to examine the ring of statues. The statues were around twice Clive's height, each one depicting a different person. From the equipment carved onto each statue, it was clear they were all adventurers. The most interesting part was that each statue had a plinth in front of it, on which rested what looked to be actual versions of some of the gear the statues had. For each statue, there were two pieces of gear waiting to be claimed. Each of the five adventurers gravitated to certain gear. Valdis to a sword and scabbard, Clive to a staff and wand. The other sets were an orb and circlet, a cloak and dagger, a sword and shield, and a single glove paired with an amulet. Clive saw no magic with his perception power, but didn't rule out some trap too powerful for his ability to pluck from hiding. He pulled out some tools, examining the plinth carefully, even as the others had already started picking up items. When he was convinced any traps that might be present were beyond his ability to uncover, Clive turned his attention to the staff and wand. The staff was carved from a dark-coloured wood, engraved with magical symbols. On the end was a base cap, with a large purple gemstone set into it. The wand was a blue metal rod with intricate lines worked into flowing patterns that ran down its length. Clive had his own ability to identify magic items, which, like most such abilities,
worked by giving him a sense of the item's properties when he touched them. Compared to the way Jason's power gave a visible explanation, he found it disappointing. While out of range of Jason, powers like the voice chat and identifying items didn't work. To Clive's delight, however, the party interface power combined with Clive's own identification ability to restore that functionality. Thus, he was happily able to read the properties of the staff. Item: Spell Lance of the Magister. Iron rank: Growth, Legendary. The staff of an ancient sorcerer. This weapon is focused on priming enemies for a potent magical assault. Weapon: Staff. Requirements: The power to wield magical tools. Basic attack: Explosive Disruptive Force Bolt. Inflicts Spell Impetus. Basic attack: Disruptive Force Beam. Consumes mana. Sustaining the beam on a target periodically inflicts Spell Impetus. Effect: Increase the mana consumption when casting a spell to increase the effect. Effect is further increased if wielding both Spell Lance of the Magister and Magister's Tithe. Spell Impetus: Affliction, magic, stacking. All resistances are reduced. When the recipient suffers an offensive spell from someone wielding Spell Lance of the Magister, all instances of Spell Impetus are consumed to increase the effect of the spell. The Magister was a potentially mythical figure whose actual existence was hotly debated. Many items and abilities were named for him or her, including two of Clive's own abilities. Regardless of the history, finding a growth weapon made the trip to the astral space a success, whatever else he encountered. He took a look at the wand. Item: Magister's Tithe. Iron rank: Growth, Legendary. The wand of an ancient sorcerer, used to sustain combat effectiveness. Weapon: Wand. Requirements: The power to wield magical tools. Basic attack: Disruptive Force Beam. Inflicts Mana Siphon. Basic attack: Mana Draining Beam. This effect is increased if wielding both Spell Lance of the Magister and Magister's Tithe. Mana Siphon. Affliction: Magic. The strength of mana drain effects against the recipient are increased. Clive stared in awe at the items in his hands. A matched set of legendary growth weapons were so good he would do well to shut up and not tell anyone, so as not to get robbed. He placed them in his inventory and turned to find four people holding out items. Valdis gave him a wry smile. You can identify items, right? Chapter 52. No one has that coming. In the aftermath of the fight with the Vorger, Jason and Sophie had no time to catch up with Neil and Jory. The flesh abomination lumbering in their direction posed a new, albeit slowly approaching, problem. They stood together, watching as the thing didn't so much walk in their direction as vaguely amble. It was basically a huge, vaguely spherical mound of muscle, skin, and fat on four short, blobby legs. Scraps of clothing and pieces of armor could be seen wedged into fatty crevices where layers of flesh and skin had folded on top of themselves. Is it attacking us? Neil asked.
It will move sluggishly until it is engaged, Shade said.
The shadowy entity who governed the trials had chosen to reappear. Also with them was Keen, the adventurer who had been travelling with Neil and Jory. So we could just leave? Neil asked.
Yes, Shade said. If you were alone, I would advise you to do so. Your collective capability should be sufficient to kill it, however, so I ask that you do. The soul within is trapped in excruciating pain, denied the release of death until its flesh prison is destroyed.
Is that one of the people that attacked us? Jory asked.
It was, Shade said. He did not flee as swiftly as his companions.
Forget it then, Neil said. He had it coming. No one has that coming, Jason said. He was trying to kill us. And if he'd still been fighting you when we arrived, Jason said, I'd help you kill him right back. But death is one thing, and having your soul trapped in pain for eternity is another.
I agree, Jory said, firmly.
Sophie? New guy? Jason said. What do you think?
Put him down, Sophie said. You were right about no one deserving that.
Am I the new guy? Keen asked.
Yeah, Jason said. But it's 3-1 already. Your vote doesn't matter anymore. Sorry.
Jason looked at the hideous blob abomination. It had at least 5 times the amount of flesh a person would have.
Shade, do you not have conservation of mass here?
We do, Shade said. We also have magic, so the laws of physics are more like strong suggestions. It's best for everyone if you adhere to them, but if you are truly reluctant, there are still modes of recourse.
You know about the laws of physics? Jason asked.
I have been a familiar many times, across many worlds. I know much.
You must be handy to have around, Jason said. And you've done a lot of familiaring, you say. I don't suppose you're looking for a new gig?
My time here ends when all the trials are passed. Pass the trials, gain the right essence ability, and we'll see.
Oh, nice, Jason said. What kind of awakening stone would that take?
All who survive this stage of the trials shall receive an awakening stone available nowhere else,
Shade said. Clive will be glad to hear that, Jason said. Doesn't he have his full set of abilities already? Neil asked.
Yeah, but you know what he's like. Give him something new and he's a kid at Christmas.
What's Christmas?
It's a religious holiday that we appropriated to stimulate the economy once a year, Jason said.
That thing is getting closer, Sophie said. Slowly, but it's getting closer. Shade, can you tell us again about the best way to fight it? A flesh abomination will adapt to how you engage it. If you are fast, it will become faster, strong, and it will become tougher. Hide, and its senses will improve. Attack from afar, and it will develop ranged attacks. Its weakness is that it cannot be all things at once. If it becomes fast and flexible, it becomes vulnerable to cutting attacks. If it develops a chitinous exterior, it becomes inflexible and slow. I advise you to use Jason Asano's necrotic powers as the main source of damage. Whatever changes it makes, flesh is flesh, and flesh can die.
Jason surveilled what was about to be their battleground. It was typical of what they had seen in the city. Jungle filled the space between the overgrown buildings. The broken stone road had soil and roots pushing up through the pavers, along with plants and full-blown trees. The footing was unsure and the terrain complex, with plenty of shadows he could use.
All right, he said. Sophie, you start us off. Get it picking up the pace to chase you around so it's nice and squishy. Then, Neil, you tie it up so I can introduce it to Colin. Sound good?
Works for me,
Sophie said.
If it's bronze rank, I won't be able to hold it for longer than a few moments, Neil said. You'll need to get your timing right.
Call it and I'll be ready, Jason said.
Jory, stick with Neil. New guy, put yourself between Jory, Neil, and the bad guy.
Not a problem, Keen said. I've been doing it for days.
Everyone knows their job then. Sophie, will you kick things off?
Sophie flashed him a grin and dashed in the direction of the abomination. She leapt high into the air, kicking off the top of the misshapen lump of flesh before landing on the other side, hitting the ground at a run.
Reckless, Jason said, shaking his head.
Then why are you grinning? Neil asked.
I have a soft spot for poor but flamboyant choices.
The creature reacted quickly, its body rapidly morphing. It shrank, moving into the shape of a fleshy beetle with 6 legs and scurrying after Sophie. Growing out of its back were 4 long, skinny arms. Lengthier than its entire body, the arms were articulated by multiple joints.
That is very disturbing, Jory said. A giant flesh bug with 4 arms sticking out of it. I think the worst part is all those extra elbows.
Sophie led the creature on a merry chase, running away and deflecting the long, grasping hands when they came close enough to grab at her. After its initial transformation, the changes in the creature had slowed but not stopped. As it chased after Sophie, it made incremental changes to its form to help in the pursuit. The body continued to shrink, the legs changed shape to better handle Sophie's speed and rapid shifts in direction.
Its arms, which she continued knocking away, went from eerily human hands to long fingers with webbing stretched between them.
"Get ready to go," Neil told Jason, who nodded.
Neil chanted a spell, and the overgrown plant life started sprouting masses of vines, lashing out to wrap around the creature. Its many arms and legs were bound up, along with its long body, completely arresting its movement. Jason emerged from a shadow, slicing the back of his hand with a razor hidden in a wristband for the purpose. From the wound, a pile of colon spewed out onto the flesh abomination, the leeches immediately digging in with their horrifying rings of teeth. System messages scrolled before Jason's eyes in rapid succession, notifying him of the afflictions Team Colon was placing. Most were resisted, but Jason's familiar power was increasing, as was his resistance penalizing aura. He gleefully noted that as many as one in three afflictions were taking hold, which was better than with previous bronze rank encounters. With sheer numbers of Team Colon, the flesh monster was quickly loaded with afflictions. Colon only had a few moments to lay in afflictions before the abomination altered its form, undertaking another massive, rapid transformation, shifting from the horizontal alignment of a hexapod to an upright biped. Four of the six legs shrank away, while the remaining pair grew bulky and strong. Its body became larger and heavier, the fleshy exterior growing thick, tough skin, with protrusions of razor-sharp bone poking through. The four arms grew shorter, but more powerful, the webbed hands replaced with savage claws. The result was something like a hairless, four-armed gorilla, covered in elephant skin with bony blades growing out of its body. The new skin was too much for the leeches to bite through. The blade bones sliced through many of the vines, and it pulled itself free of the rest with brute strength. The vines tried to entangle it again, but the creature powered free of their grasp, shedding leeches like droplets of water in the process. During the transformation, Jason was not idle, taking the opportunity to lay in with his spells. They lacked immediate impact and were repeatedly resisted, but were quick to cast. By the time the abomination broke free and resumed its angry pursuit of Sophie, Jason had afflicted it with his key powers. The abomination was now loaded up with ongoing necrotic damage from Colin, plus bleeding and blood poison. The bleed would soak up the creature's regeneration that would have otherwise healed it, the bleed only ending once it soaked a certain amount of healing. The poison would then reapply the bleed effect every time it dropped off. This was important, as the abomination had altered itself to accelerate healing in an attempt to adapt to Jason's afflictions, but all that regeneration went to waste. The other pillars holding up Jason's house of affliction were the sin affliction, which increased all necrotic damage suffered, and inexorable doom, which added to any affliction in place. The combination of leech necrotoxin and the necrosis accelerating sin both increasing over time was a multiplicative escalation of the damage, while the bleeding and anticoagulant leech toxin kept the monstrosity's regeneration in check. The escalating effects of Jason's afflictions had placed the abomination's life on a clock. That left the question of how much damage the abomination could inflict before that clock ran out. In the immediacy, the creature's inevitable demise was not apparent, as the abomination thrashed at the leeches still falling off its body. Jason retreated to the shadows and recalled the leeches, which started disappearing as they contacted the blood on the hand he lowered to receive them. They were quite spread out, however, and could only slowly make their way to his hidden position. The flesh monstrosity lacked the intelligence to follow their direction to Jason's hidden location. His cloak melded him perfectly into the shadow, hiding him even from whatever senses the flesh monster relied on without eyes or ears. The abomination furiously stomped on leeches to little avail. They had been quite scattered by the monster shaking them off. Unable to catch the elusive Sophie, it stopped. Its four arms and the bony protrusions retracted as its body returned to a more blob-like shape, while keeping the thick hide. Welt marks appeared all over its surface, with tiny bone needles shooting out in every direction a moment later. Keen used his shield to shelter Jory, Neil, and himself. Neil had cast his giant's might spell on Keen shortly after Sophie had begun combat, and the shield bearer was twice his normal size, as was the conjured shield in front of him. It was Sophie, Jason, and Colin who should have taken the brunt of the attack, but Neil was on the ball, a bubble-like shield snapping up around Sophie.
It only lasted a moment, but a moment was all she needed to shift behind a tree with her mirage step power. The afterimage left behind by her ability didn't seem to fool the abomination's eyeless, earless senses, and it didn't keep attacking her. Jason's hidden position meant Neil couldn't see him to provide another shield. This left Jason as the only person who didn't avoid the attack. The needles that dug into him were light, but they were also a bronze rank attack. They pierced through his cloak and, in many places, the armor underneath. All Jason had time to do was turn his body away from the attack and shield his face before the needles struck. He ducked behind a tree as more of the bone needles poured out of the abomination. Team Colin took the worst of it. Only a fraction of leech mass had returned to Jason before the rest were skewered with bone needles. Some, still clinging to the abomination, had been shot off by needles. Most were exposed on the ground and riddled with needles. Generally, Jason didn't have to worry about the welfare of Team Colin. Very few monsters had the kind of area attacks that could pose a danger to the regenerating leech swarm. This time, Jason had only absorbed a fraction of Colin's full mass, which would take a day or two to replenish itself in the safety of Jason's bloodstream. As the accelerated healing Jason received from Colin was based on how much of the mass was currently residing in his blood, the effect would be significantly reduced until the leech swarm recovered. Fortunately, the healing they offered had grown stronger as Jason's familiar power advanced. What was a reduced effect now was similar to when he had first obtained the ability. While all the afflictions were locked in, and its death was now inevitable, the abomination was, for the moment, still full of life. The necrosis was causing patches of blackened flesh to ooze blood, but the monstrosity did not yet appear impeded. Of its opponents, Jason and Sophie were hidden, and what remained of the leeches were dead. That left Keen, Neil, and Jory to its attentions, and there was no hiding Keen's enlarged body. The abomination morphed again, bulking up and dropping to four powerful legs as a huge bony spike emerged from the front. It now resembled a rhino whose entire head was a horn. It charged directly at Keen. It quickly built up speed as it charged, but it was no match for Sophie, who emerged from her hiding spot and raced ahead of it. Putting herself between the monster and the others, she was suddenly thrown violently sideways as Jason emerged from a nearby shadow, crash-tackling her out of the way and letting the monster pass.
"What are you doing?"
Sophie yelled at him as she extricated herself from his rough embrace.
"Your ability can only stop so much, remember?" Jason yelled at her. "Trust your allies."
Sophie glared at him, then down at her arm, remembering the broken mess it had been the last time an attack had overwhelmed her defensive power. That had taken her magic power the better part of a day to heal. This flesh monster's charge would certainly have been more powerful. Neil, Jory, and Keen had been moving and fighting through the city together for several days. With monsters so thick on the ground, that was enough time and enough fights to find each other's combat rhythms. It was an unusual mix, with no dedicated damage dealer, but Neil and Jory both had powerful buffs that could turn Keen into a walking fortress. Already giant-sized from Neil's spell, Neil gave him another spell, Bolster, that would enhance his next active essence ability use. Jory, meanwhile, had a cluster of small, clear orbs floating around him. Material started floating out of his pockets and belts, hovering in front of him. Trace elements mixed with a substance he conjured out of thin air, resulting in a small red blob that one of the orbs